Good evening, and thank you to everyone for joining us tonight, whether here at Alumni Hall at Purdue Northwest in Hammond or on the air at Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, online lakeshorepublicradio.org, or streaming live on the Times Facebook page. This is the Lake County Sheriff's Forum, in which we've included all eight Democratic candidates and Officer Dan Bursak, who is the lone Republican candidate joining us tonight. I am Tom Maloney with Lakeshore Public Radio, and I'll be your moderator for this evening's forum. Tonight's forum will allow us to meet all of the candidates for the sheriff's race. If you have any questions, please submit them to the League of Women Voters by raising your hand. They will bring you a card and a pencil or pen to go ahead and fill out a question. And thank you again to Purdue Northwest for hosting this event this evening at Alumni Hall. And of course, thank you to WBEZ, The Times, and the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area for making all of this possible this evening. And we're going to go ahead and get things started because we do have a lot of candidates on the table. So we've got now a 30-second intro for each candidate. And starting off will be Richard Ligon to my right. Is it Ligon? Ligon. All right, Mr. Ligon, take it away.
Yeah, my name is Richard Ligon. I'm a retired Army colonel with 36 years experience. I'm also a retired federal agent with 23 years experience working violent crimes in Detroit, Chicago, both the South Side and West Side, as well as Indianapolis. And my last assignment, I supervised agents in the Northern District of Indiana, covering the whole Northern District from Fort Wayne back. Also, I'm graduated from Valparaiso University with a master's degree in criminal justice.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Maria Garcia Trajkovic, and I work for the Lake County Sheriff's Department. I'm currently a police officer, corporal there at the department. Have 20 years experience throughout the department and different divisions there at the Lake County Sheriff's Department. I decided I wanted to do it this time because of the last two previous sheriffs we had before the current sheriff, the debacles that we've experienced and the black eyes that we've received that, you know, I decided enough is enough. So I'm here now, and I'm going to represent our department, and I believe that I could be the leader for the sheriff's department.
Good evening. My name is Wally D. Rose. I'm a former Gary police officer, retired with 20 years, a federal agent with U.S. State Department Diplomatic Security Service. I served tours in Iraq. I also am a Army, have honorable discharge from the U.S. Army, and I have an associate degree, a bachelor's degree, and a master's degree from Valparaiso University. I was also a volunteer for the National Center for Missing and Supported Children, and did various assignments throughout the world.
Good evening. My name is Mike Brown. I currently serve as your Lake County Clerk. I've been honored to serve at that capacity. I've been elected twice as your county recorder. Each time I've taken that office and taken it to a better level. I'm currently serving as your Lake County Clerk. I've served 9 years, and I hope to leave that office in better shape than when I found it. I hope to be your next county sheriff with a chance to make the sheriff's office better. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is David Dowling. Thank you to everyone for being here tonight to be engaged in our election process. I was born and raised in Hammond and have spent my professional career with the Sherrillville Police Department. I have served in every administrative position at the department, including 10 years as the chief of police. What sets me apart is I am an experienced police administrator. I bring successful community policing strategies and programming that can be immediately put into place. I have a 34-year unblemished record of service, which is something we desperately need at this time.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dan Bursak. I've been with the Lake County Sheriff's Department for over 26 years in numerous areas of the department. I bring my experience that I've found in the areas of crime lab, delivering papers in the civil division, transportation, everything. I know how it is to be punished because you get bounced from pillar to post, especially after 2002 when I first decided to run for sheriff.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Oscar Martinez. I am a 25-year veteran with the Lake County Sheriff's Department. I worked in every division in the Lake County Sheriff's Department and expertise in narcotics. I've been blessed and honored to be your Lake County Sheriff, and since taking office, we've been faced with a lot of challenges. I'm proud to say that with the command staff that we have, myself and my command staff has taken those challenges and attacked it head-on. I hope to talk about some of these issues that we've had in our sheriff's department, what we've done to correct them.
I want to thank the League of Women Voters and those who participated in hosting this event, and to you, the audience. I'm a candidate for Lake County Sheriff because I care and I understand the needs of this community and how to protect our loved ones. A sheriff must have administrative skills and leadership and equality and integrity to implement the changes that is necessary and not the same status quo. I am not being endorsed by any political groups, but I will be a sheriff for this county. On May 8th, I would appreciate your vote.
Okay. On to the last one.
Good evening. My name is Nate Hall, and I'm a candidate for the office of Lake County Sheriff. I'm a retired law enforcement officer with over 38 years of experience and a graduate of the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy, who will provide the safety and the law and order that is needed for all of Lake County. Experience is not anything. Experience is everything. I have a bachelor's degree in business administration and a master's degree in sociology.
Okay. We're going to go ahead now to begin the question and answer process. The way this is going to work is we're going to have two questions from the panelists and then two questions from myself, the moderator, coming from the audience. Then back to the panelists again for two questions, back to the audience questions. So we will start with Richard Ligon down here on my right. Ligon, I'm sorry. And for the panelists, please go ahead and introduce yourselves before you ask the question so the candidates know who you are.
I'm Michael Puente, a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago.
First question. Go ahead with the first question.
Okay, my question is, here it goes. Recently, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart sued Yahoo to compel it to release information regarding an email account sending malicious allegations about him. A similar incident happened in Lake County with the city sheriff using police resources to investigate a so-called fake Facebook account. Is this the proper use of police resources, considering negative comments are protected speech?
First,
Richard, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, incidents like that should be handled properly by either the state police or someone higher to make sure that there is no bias. And if evidence is found, then the proper punishment or justice should be done. This stuff like this is during the political season happens, and sometimes people are trying to do things to upset people. To me, that's a form of integrity, a lack of integrity. We have to maintain integrity. Stuff like that, you would just ignore, or information like that, you ignore, and you go on about the business of taking care of the sheriff's department and the county and changing the image.
In answering that question, I wish we would react that quick to our kids that are in school with cyberbullying. If we would act that fast with them, they probably won't take their own lives as they do now because they don't have the mentality or capabilities to handle cyberbullying like that, which this is a form of. I don't believe, unless it's detrimental to your health and well-being or attack on your family or an outright threat, no, I think it's a waste of our time, and I think it's the waste of the state police time or anybody else investigating something like that. For someone saying that you're ugly and your mother dresses you funny, come on, folks, we're adults.
I would question what is the legislative intent of this law. I'm not familiar with that law, but if it's a law that it is enacted by the state legislature, then, of course, it has to be carried out. The question is, it's very suspicious that it's brought out during an election time. I'd rather not see it enacted, but if there's a violation of the law, it has to be investigated.
I think that at the end of the day, we're supposed to be running for office and have integrity as elected officials. Being an elected official two times Every time something occurred, I made sure an outside agency not connected with me investigated it. There's no way you can investigate yourself. There's no way to do it properly. If you have an issue about something that someone has done, it should not be done, one, during work hours. It should not be done under your leadership. It should be done in a way that the person that gathers the evidence has no reason whatsoever to be prejudiced about the issue that's in front of them. So therefore, I think that at the end of the day, we need to be more professional about the way we handle ourselves, because the public doesn't respect us because we're acting like the people that we're supposed to be protecting.
Okay. David.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll be happy to address this. I consider this really an important issue, because I think any professional law enforcement administrator would not handle it in the way that we have just seen. If for some reason you feel that you allegedly are a victim, that information immediately has to be sent out to another agency. In this situation, people were basically, it was sent out to the media and not to the proper law enforcement agency from the beginning. I don't think there's much to this. I think it's a sad commentary on where we're at in the abuse of power that's going on currently. This is one of many issues I hope we get to tonight that I'm ready to speak to. And I'm proud of the record I have and feel strongly that it's just not a professional way for a police administrator to handle things.
I myself feel that this is a ridiculous claim. It doesn't seem like there's any kind of crime here. Just because you were called a name, who cares? Politics is a bloody sport, and you got to learn to take it. So you need to look at the other way. What I'm wanting to know is who signed off on these warrants to get the information. That's the real crux of the matter.
That is a great question. One of the things that there's misunderstanding here, you're right about freedom of speech. There is a freedom of speech of saying, what you want, but you're also held accountable to a certain extent. The investigation that happened with the individuals that was a complaint filed was in reference to synthetic identity, that there is a law against a synthetic identity. And legislation is always struggling to keep up with technology when they're coming out with new laws. I've said since 2010 and 2014 that I was going to create a cyber unit and to investigate cyber crimes and cyber bullying and so on and so forth. Subpoenas are signed by a prosecutor. There has to be a crime allegedly being committed and what's being investigated. Then the judge or the prosecutor signs. It's then taken to the judge. The judge looks into what's being investigated, and then the judge signs off on it. All subpoena records go to them. And when it's discovered that there may be a conflict, then it's turned over by the state police doing the right thing.
I think this whole thing is a waste of taxpayers' money. Politicians and candidates always have negative criticism. That's the way politics is. We have to withstand that. I think to use your office to investigate a case, and I understand the state police is investigating this matter, and they will come up with some kind of a disposition. But at this time, it's not going to be like a week from now. It's not going to be 2 weeks from now. It's going to be months from now. So what's the problem here? Is that because somebody's calling each other names? That's on Facebook. I understand the law. I've been a probation officer for 33 years, but this is really a waste of taxpayers' money.
Go ahead.
I read the article in a paper. I'm not familiar with all the facts as far as the allegations are concerned, but I will say that if there's a law, and it's a standing law that's on the books, then that law must be followed. If there's an individual that violated that law, then that individual or those individuals should suffer whatever consequences the law states and says. We cannot overlook the law and make our own laws or determination or decision as to what we prosecute or we don't prosecute. So if those facts are what they say they are, then those situations should occur and that person should be prosecuted.
Okay, really quick before we move on to the next question, if I can ask the candidates to just state their names before they answer the question, so that way the listeners over the air know who each person is who's talking, so that way the names and the voices aren't running together. So up next is Susan, and please introduce yourself.
I'm Susan Duncan with the League of Women Voters. This question is about immigration. Tell us about department policies concerning undocumented immigrants. What should the Sheriff Department's working relationship be with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency?
And we'll start that question now with Maria.
Hi, Maria Trajkovich. My solution to that would be to find out exactly if this person's here on a visa or not, and to help that person to see if they can obtain the correct papers to be here. And to deal with ICE, I've not dealt in that capacity. I apologize for that. But I believe finding out more about the immigration and the laws in reference to how we would deal with that, I wish I could better answer that for you, but in all honesty, I can't. I'm sorry.
The problem is that, I'm sorry, Wally DeRose. The problem is that these laws are enacted at the federal level, and local jurisdictions only carry out what the federal jurisdictions dictate. That said, it's higher than the Sheriff's Department's salary level to respond to those questions. It can only be handled at the judicial level, and those have to be worked out between the federal partners and the local jurisdictions. Actually, it's a larger scale than that. It goes far beyond that.
Mike Brown, I have to totally agree with what he's saying, but more importantly, what happens with the laws is, whether federal or state or local, they expect the law enforcement officers to enforce those laws. In this country, most of us are from somewhere else to start with. We need to stop making it such an emotional issue and just be honest with each other. We should be able to live with each other. That being said, from a legal standpoint, we have to work within the laws that do exist. And I think we need to talk to our legislators to make those changes, because everything that's done is done through law. And a sheriff can only work with the law that's in front of them. As county clerk, I only work through IC code. So if there's a law that's in place, you work with that law. But you should try to have a good relationship with the community. And you should do everything in your power to keep the community safe, no matter what race or sexuality a person has. Thank you.
David?
David Dowling. You know, whenever we talk about immigration, obviously it's a very sensitive issue. Like some of the other speakers have already said, all of us have come from somewhere. I think this is a prime example why it's important to have a regional approach to law enforcement, partnerships with both state, local, and the U.S. Attorney's Office, and try to follow those guidelines. The rule of law is very important. However, I think from a sheriff's standpoint, we're all running for sheriff. So from a sheriff's standpoint, probably the biggest part that we have in this is housing people from time to time at the jail. I know there's not a big number of that right now, but the county does get reimbursed from the federal government. But I think it's a partnership between state, local, and federal government developing that policy.
My name is Dan Bursak. I'm a firm believer in the Constitution. And the Constitution, as a constitutional sheriff, what I would do is I would make sure that if the federal agents would come in here, ICE, be it whatever, FBI, CIA, whatever federal, they would have to come through our office. We would make sure that all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted, and then we would go there. We would work hand in hand with the feds. My parents both came over from this country. And they took 3 years that they had to wait in Germany because my dad wanted to make sure that his family was raised in United States. So they came here legally. It's not fair to let somebody come in and take cuts, basically. And I'm a firm believer in being fair with everybody. So that's what I would do, is I would make sure that everything was taken care of properly and according to the Constitution.
Well, I can tell you right now that we're not going to be playing the immigration police while we're out there. One of the things that we deal with in our jail is that you will get ICE coming into our jail trying to house some individuals that may be illegal. We will not accept them. We're not obligated to accept them because unless they have a court order or that individual committed another crime, drug trafficking or victims of human trafficking, then we'll accept them. But it has to be another crime besides just illegal immigration. So we don't have to accept them unless there is a court order forcing us to take them. Other than that, they're not coming into our jail unless they have committed another crime, domestic violence, gun trafficking, drug trafficking. Other than just immigration alone, we will not accept them into our jail. If they do a blitz going after illegal immigrants, well, we'll supply whatever resources we can to assist another agency because we're obligated by law to assist other agencies, but that's as far as that will go.
Hi, I'm Betty Dominguez. You know, as a sheriff, you must enforce the law, but you can do it humanely. It is possible that you're dealing with the family as well, who has going to be separated for a very long time. So I think it's important to look at that aspect. You must enforce the constitutional law. If a person is not a legal alien, you must have to do what you need to do, but you must treat them humanely. And think about the families that's being affected, the children that are being affected. You must have some kind of understanding, though I feel, you, as a sheriff, you must obey the law.
Nate Hall, my personal feelings are different than what the law states. The sheriff cannot ignore any federal law dealing with immigrants, illegal immigrants as well. So that being said, that if in fact you have to enforce the law as the sheriff, you must comply 100%. There are several cities that have determined or decided that they wanted to be sanctuary cities. There is no humane way of doing this at this point, unfortunately. The sheriff is the sheriff and he must follow the law to the letter of the law.
Okay. And again, if you have questions, please raise your hands and members of the League of Women Voters will find you out. Oh, I'm sorry. Richard.
You're picking on me. my name is Richard Ligon. The Lake County Sheriff Department does not have the authority to enforce federal laws. However, you must develop a relationship with the federal authorities. So whatever you can do to develop that relationship, that's what you do, but you have to stay in your lane. However, the Sheriff Department will fully cooperate. They have to cooperate with the federal authorities to develop that relationship. But I, as a sheriff, will ensure that all individuals are treated with dignity, respect, and that their constitutional rights are not violated. And that's the most important thing. We cannot violate anyone's rights, but we must develop these relationships.
Thank you, Colonel. Okay, as I was saying, if you have questions, please raise your hands, and the League of Women Voters will track you down. They'll give you a white 3x5 card here along with a pen or a pencil to go ahead and ask the question. We've taken two questions from the panelists, and we'll now take two questions from the audience. This is a combination of a couple of questions that were asked from two different individuals. And this question will start with Wally. What would your plan be, or what would your plans be to protect so-called soft targets like schools from shootings?
I think those plans should have been enacted a long time ago. It's a simple strategy where you use patrol cars. One patrol car with two people in it, male or female or male and male. They're sitting at that squad car in front of these schools. They can utilize one officer to go in, one officer to go out, and have a cover car that relieves them every hour. So you've got one squad car there at the school. It's relieved every hour. The vehicle, it remains stationary or mobile. It can always respond inside the school at the same time. It saves money and saves manpower.
I think, Mike Brown, I think the most important thing you need to find out is what is the level of threat for those schools. You need to find out if there is someone in that school that is online making threats to other students. But the main thing is, if you have officers available, you should have officers that are going to work those schools. I think that's important. But they need to work inside and out. They shouldn't just be outside. And they should have training with the students, with the faculty, so they're familiar with each other, because a lot of times there's a disconnect. And we don't want the disconnect, because if you connect it with the students, a lot of them will give you information about what's going on in that particular school. And we also need to be on social media. There's a lot of ways you need to attack it. But one way is to have a dummy site where the kids can, you know, give information to you, and you can get ahead of it yourself and be able to prevent some of that. Thank you.
David.
David Dowling. I'm very happy that question was asked. I feel like I've had a lot of experience in this area. In the Tri-Town area, for the last 4 years, we've been meeting monthly, the three chiefs. In Tri-Town area, Schererville, St. John, Dyer, all feed into Lake Central High School. And for the last 4 years, we've had monthly meetings with the police chiefs, fire chiefs, and school administrators. And the majority of those meetings is also attended by the superintendent. And through that, we've discussed school-related issues, mostly always security issues, and we come up with a program that way. In Schererville, for example, when our officers weren't busy, if they're working on a report, they're instructed to sit in the school parking lot. They are there, ready to respond. I think all those things are critically important. But what's most important is developing that partnership, that we form a committee with the school security officials in the schools to come up with a policy together, so we're on the same protocol. There's been a lot of talk about that recently, but that is the most important thing, is that we're on the same page in this county, because we will all respond to a crisis situation.
Dan Bursak, what I would implement would be to reach out to all the school resource officers, have them utilize like the DARE program, have them looking into that, checking social medias, talking to the kids, making sure we get more contact with the kids in school. Also, there's a lot of retirees that would love to have a part-time job. There's also, you know, side jobs that guys could have. What I would do is I would instruct my officers, if you have to stop and write a report, do it in a school parking lot. You know, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. And then more training. Have officer-involved shooting type of scenarios. Run those kind of scenarios on a different basis. Make sure that the Sheriff's Department has on file the blueprints of every school in that area. That way we'll know where's the weak points, where we need to do.
Hello, Sheriff Martinez here. 2 days before the Florida shooting, I held a big meeting with all the chief of police in the county to come out with a countywide protocol on how to address this issue. It was shocking to me to know that some agencies haven't trained an active shooter in over 3 years. One of the things that we're doing, and we've been doing training with other agencies, multi-jurisdictional training with schools. We have to look towards investing more money into our schools, because we invest so much money into fire safety, but when you look into the last 50 years, you haven't had a student killed in a school fire. So we need to start investing more money in reinforced doors, training with our administrators, and also beyond that. What I've started was a place of worship active shooter as well, where we've been doing seminars and meeting with a lot of churches around the county on how to do a security assessment and come up with a plan to keep their congregation safe as well.
Betty Dominguez, you know what? The incident at Parkland was really sad, but they did have a resource officer at the school, and it still happened. I think educating our children, the teachers, to spot mental health, those things happened. We were all in high school. We knew what occurred. We knew when things were not going right with a person. To make a phone call, tell the counselor. To me, education is the key. And well, working with the police department, a hotline for them to be able to call to say those things, and giving police officer more authority at this point to do that with the court system. I think that is very important.
I've spoken with several kids, young adults, college students, at all different levels of school, college, and high school, and so forth. The things that are occurring now and happening now did not occur many years ago. And the children, these young adults, they stated that they have been ignored, that they've tried to identify these suspects, their classmates that have these emotional problems, that act out in manners of anger, and they have no problem with armed guards, police being in the schools. They don't want teachers armed. They believe that their voice has not been heard, and it needs to be heard, so we can identify these parties and these children who are buying guns as young adults at 18 and coming into these schools, because all schools are not safe, and the incidents can happen today or tomorrow at any school. The police department can work along with the teachers and administrators,
but
must have to hear the children.
My name is Richard Ligon. As a federal agent, I worked a great deal of mass murders, and that was sad. What I've been concentrating on in the last 5 years is working on school security plans. And the things that I found out were the issues were accountability. A lot of times the teachers don't know where the students are. The second issue was the building. The buildings are not locked. A lot of the schools, the buildings are, anyone can just walk through the schools. And my wife was a principal at one, and we worked hard to get that school security plan in place. What we have to do is make sure that the doors are locked, it's secured, and accountability is important. For 5 years, we've made a difference here. We do tabletop exercises when we go in to train, and we make sure that the teachers and the principal are aware that anything can happen in their particular district. But the most important thing, make sure that building is secured and your cameras are set up in the event it does, and make sure you have the emergency numbers.
Maria Trajkovic, I believe that armed police officers in the schools is detrimental to the safety of the staff and the children and everybody inside the building. Honestly, folks, what would we do right now as adults if somebody walked through that door right now? Are we prepared? No, we're not. Do you know why? Because we don't have information on that. We need to develop a social influence with the community and give them information in reference to what's going on and what they need to do. Prepare the schools. Have some type of program in place or alert system where they know if a teacher hears something suspicious, they can lock their door immediately and get a hold of somebody else in the building to let them know that something is not right or there is a problem. I worked in the schools before I became a police officer as a guidance counselor, and I dealt with many, many children. And officers were in place at that time, and that was about 30 years ago, and they were already in place. But we always think it can't happen to us, or we live so far south it's not going to happen. So we need to prepare for it and be better informed.
Okay. And just once again, if you have questions, please raise your hands, and the League of Women Voters will track you down and give you a card to go ahead and fill that out. You are listening to or watching the Lake County Sheriff's Forum here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And the second question coming from the audience, I'm going to paraphrase a bit, and we're going to start this question now with Mike Brown. What are your plans based on what's currently being done about drug trafficking and mules across Northwest Indiana and the drug opioid crisis here in the region?
Mike Brown, I think it's a very important issue. The problem with drugs throughout the Midwest has to be attacked. I know that a lot of people say, well, you know, it's out of control, but it really isn't. I think we have to have a comprehensive plan, because people generally know who's selling drugs, who's moving the drugs, and I think that a lot of times our patrol officers, our hands are kind of tied, and they don't have the ability to get out and find more people that are pushing those drugs. But we also need to work with other agencies and find out through mutual aid who actually has a high area of drug traffic, and go in that area and help to make absolutely sure that we can get that down, because we don't have enough arrests, and the opioid crisis is huge. A lot of people are ODing. In fact, I saw on the news today where they're putting, rat poison in this synthetic marijuana. So, I mean, they go from one extreme to another, and we have a responsibility to stop it.
David.
David Dowling, I feel like I have a lot of experience over the years in this area. For example, until I retired here recently, for several years I've been on the board of directors for the HIDA. Also, I'm a former interim director at HIDA, and I think that gives me a unique perspective that no one else has. As far as the opiate crisis, we must use a combination of education, awareness, treatment, and enforcement to address all these. We need all three categories. For example, these are examples of what we've done and what I've done. In Sherrville, we partnered directly with the treatment facility so we could connect people with treatment. A person then could come to the PD connected with treatment without fear of arrest. Of the referrals, none of them were a result of a criminal arrest. Lake Central High School and School Corporation has worked with many partners on the awareness and education piece. This past year was their second event. It was a great example of engaging in the community. The thing that I'm really proud of, and I'll have to stop with that, and I won't go any further.
Dan Bursak, the key to this is the patrol officer. They're the ones that are on the streets. They're the ones that are talking to the informants. What they need to do is, you know, go after the gangs also. The gangs are the ones that are here accepting the drugs. So the drugs have to get here. You have the gangs that are distributing it. So if you go after the gangs and eliminate that problem, you cut that off. Also, in working with the schools, you can get in there and talk to these kids. That's where DARE program comes in, you know. Make sure that they know what, you know, what happens and what, you know, what can actually, you know, how they can affect their lives in the future. So that's what I would end up doing, is I would increase the awareness of the patrol officers, make sure that they get in there and go after the gangs.
Sheriff Martinez, we've been taking action and getting results. We created a highway interdiction unit and a high crime unit that's been out there enforcing the laws, out there making drug seizures, out there making gun seizures, and also over $200,000 of drug proceeds seizures. One of the things that we're doing is taking it a step further. We're doing controlled deliveries. We're gathering intelligence on these individuals to create a bigger case, partnering up with the DEA, the FBI, so we can get convictions against these bigger organizations. We've seized over 1,000 grams of heroin. That's important. With that stuff that's not hitting our streets, that's over $100,000 worth of heroin there. And with the opioid crisis, we've been doing prevention programs through SVU and through our jail with our veterans and people addicted to narcotics coming into our jail. So they've been going through a recovery program. I hope we can talk a little bit more about it. And my time is up.
Hi, I'm Betty Dominguez. You know what? We've been fighting drugs, opiate, marijuana, heroin, and everything else. I've been a probation officer for 33 years. We've been dealing with this problem. We've had police officers, state, local, federal, they all walk together. But drugs are still on the streets. There's got to be a reason why. Because people do want it. So we have to educate them. And how bad it is. The crime rate is high. In Porter County, the suicide rate is also high. On overdose, it happens every day. You read about it in the paper every day. So there's got to be a better communication with the police department, though they've been here for a very long time. And I don't see a lot of this drug bust. And when they do, they go right back and do it again. So putting them in prison, locking them up, has not worked. I've been dealing with them. I've dealt with thousands of defendants, dealing with drug addiction, okay. Alcohol.
Ma'am, sorry. What's your time?
My time is up.
Nate?
Nate Hall, as a former DEA agent and narcotics and vice detective, there's been different drugs of choice for individuals throughout the years. At this particular time, Porter County is experiencing not only a crisis but an epidemic as far as the opioid situation is concerned. Some of the other candidates have expressed some good things. One of those would be we need to educate these people as far as the type of drugs they are using and what the results will be at a later date if they continue to abuse themselves with these drugs. Also, programs need to be set up to help these individuals. And last but not least, as far as forming different task force or whatever, if that needs to be done, then that needs to be done if, in fact, we're going to fight the opioid crisis.
Yeah, my name is Richard Ligon. I had a unique skill set. I was a federal agent dealing with the Postal Service. We did numerous controlled deliveries, took a lot of drugs off the street. But also, as a battalion commander, we created the counter-drug program. It was called the Drug Demand Reduction Program. We had soldiers that were returning from deployment that we actually placed in this program, and they would mentor youth. They had a lot of funds, but this counter-drug program, it was called the Drug Demand Reduction Program. It created that relationship. Also, we used some of the military people as they used their techniques and worked with different departments, which allowed them to be part of the seizure money. All of that money was basically used for program for drug, for the prevention in young people, and it touched the young people and their families. So that program was very effective, and we need to make sure that program is back.
Maria Trajkovich, I worked in the NARCS unit myself. I worked as an undercover agent at the Drug Task Force for the Sheriff's Department for 3.5 years. During that time, I gained a lot of experience with the hands-to-hands. I also did. Of course, we have the mules going back and forth on our highways and expressways, although I haven't seen any cartels caught yet. I don't know if you have, but I haven't. I think that's good that we're pulling drugs off the street. I think that's great we're getting the money to buy equipment and being able to seize this stuff. But I want to see convictions. That's what I want to do. And that's a lot of hard work because that's a lot of boring work of surveillance. That's interacting with the community. That's informing folks. You know, we went from no pain to everybody get something for pain now, where nobody got anything before. And moving this stuff back and forth, we have to go to the root of it, folks. It's the community. It's the kids that are getting it, and it's an easy buy for these kids. It's not a cheap drug. It's not difficult for them to obtain it. We have to, by geographic information, find out where it's going.
Ma'am?
As a commanding officer in the Gary, Indiana Police Department, which watched crime after crime after crime related to narcotics. Later on, when I became a special agent with the U.S. State Department, I was tasked with the responsibility of overseeing security at U.S. embassies, Afghanistan, Islamabad, Pakistan, Iraq. All these places, you could watch our soldiers walk through poppy fields. As your sheriff, I will enact my political power by educating the public and making sure they go to the congressmen and the legislatures, demanding action be taken at the top. Where the drugs come from, it has to stop. Those poppy fields have to be destroyed. We have the power to do it, but nobody's stepping forward to do it. I will.
Okay. We now go to the panelist question. Mark, please introduce yourself.
I'm Mark Chase with The Times. Good evening. Runaway overtime has become a problem at the Lake County Jail under recent administrations. Some jailers working 100-plus hour work weeks are averaging that. It's become a multi-million-dollar problem for taxpayers. What have you done or what would you do to rein in this problem?
And we'll start with David on this question.
Sure. Again, it's an area that I feel like I have some experience in, and while I haven't run the jail, I've run a police department that in 2013, a year after I came back in as chief, that we put together a strategy to address such things, and we were very successful. And it was a 12-hour shift. When you do a 12-hour shift, you have more manpower, and with that manpower, you know, by public safety standards, you can work them up to 80 employees up to 86 hours of pay period before overtime kicks in, and it's a scheduling issue. You don't approve time off when there is a, when you're at staffing levels that are at minimums, and unfortunately, I think a lot of that was done in the past. So I have had experience in that. It's been very successful for us where I've come from, and I would take the standards from that to the jail. It's just about managing your people properly and being fiscally accountable to the public.
Dan Bursak, I myself, when I got on the department, they had the Jensen decree was put into place. So they didn't allow police officers to work the jail. They pulled all the police officers out and replaced them with correctional officers. Being that as a fact, if I would win this office during the interim, I would actually go in and work the jail for quite a while to see how it is run, to see where it could be improved. Basically, it's a manpower issue, and you need to deploy your people where you need them. But for me to see it, I have to see it from the inside. It was the one thing that I kind of regretted not working the jail, because you were able to make a lot of connections with these inmates, and you can get basically snitches that can help you once you hit the streets. So we didn't have that. So we had to work harder on the road. So if I'm fortunate enough to be elected sheriff, I guarantee you during my transition period of time, I'd work the jail.
That's your time.
One of the major problems that we had under the last administration, that when the last sheriff appointed corporals or specialty, like training division, he gave out 40 hours of comp time, 40 hours that was illegal that you cannot give out without council approval. I eliminated that immediately, because when those officers are on comp time, that's 4,000 hours of comp time. That means they're off. That means you got to hold somebody that's already on a 12-hour shift 8 hours only, so they're short another 4 hours. So we eliminated that. We made sure that they got paid, increased their working with the council, which we think we're going to end up getting, increased their pay from $31,000, get it close to the national average. That's at $45,000 a year. By doing that, it increased retention, improves recruitment, and reduces overtime. That is important. You get what you pay for. We're 20 officers short, so increase their pay and eliminate all the unnecessary comp time that's given to them that was illegal and improper.
Hi, Betty Dominguez. I think, Mark, you wrote an article on that one, indicating that one correctional officer at a base pay of $31,000 made $98,000 that year. That is a lot of money. I don't know when she slept at this point. But the thing is, you're right, is training. Oscar did do right as far as knocking down the overtime and the corporal. I understand that. But the thing, you need to do more, okay? Training. Making sure that the correctional officers are respected. I think that's a big deal at this point. Being a county employee, you don't get that respect. So you don't work as hard. So you try to hide. You try to do other things. I've worked with the Lake County Jail since 1978. I know what happens in that jail as well as in the county. But the thing is, it is important that we become fiscally responsible and not giving anybody overtime. The national average for a correction officer,
ma'am,
as a matter of fact, is $25,000.
Nate Hall, staffing is the most important issue as far as overtime in any department is going to be concerned with. If, in fact, you utilize your resources as far as your offices are concerned, and in that point, as far as the jail is concerned, with violent and nonviolent offenders as well, if we have an abundance of nonviolent offenders, then we need to reduce their sentence and their stay so you don't have that overflow. And the second part is to utilize the manpower resources that you do have at that time to be able to effectively patrol the jail and keep the jail safe.
My name is Richard Ligon. I've learned in federal law enforcement as well as in the military, accountability is the most important thing. When you have accountability, you're going to check this. You're going to check. I checked every single hour that my inspectors worked. In the military, everything is monitored. Last time, I said I would walk through that jail every morning just to take a look at it to see. But not only that, that's one of the main responsibilities of the sheriff department is to take care of the jail. Also, there's a program called the Memphis Plan, and I'm sure people will research this, but we can eliminate a lot of the people that are in jail, the veterans. You know, they should be going to the VA if they're drunk or whatever and not put in jail. So what we're going to do is try to reduce. If we build another jail, we'll fill it up. We have to make sure that we're doing preventive things to keep people from being in jail. So accountability and checking the records and finding it's ridiculous for some.
That's your time, sir.
Maria Trajkovic, I would stay informed every day on a daily basis and meet with the administrators in the jail, and also make sure that the right people are in the right places in the jail and that they're performing their job duties as needed. That's detrimental to the, and I use that word all the time, for the correction officers and for the inmates that we house for to care for them. A lot of this overtime was because of nepotism and favoritism, putting people in these spots where these people don't need to be because they don't understand the job or the job description or are doing what they're supposed to be doing at that job. Overtime is offered to some folks. Overtime is rejected for others, and that's the county way, whether it's on the police side or the jail side. So we need to cut back on both with the overtime and watch and be accountable. Mr. Liggins is absolutely correct with that, accountability. We need to be accountable and tell you exactly why we're staying over at our positions, whether we're on the police side or the jail side.
Wally.
Wally DeRose, as a former Gary police commander, we had a very difficult time with our jail. We finally got rid of it. It's a miserable job. And what we did is we had diversion. You divert from a jail population. That population has to be reduced. And what you do is try to develop programs. We develop programs with the city judge where she would, if there's a fine line upon sentencing to jail or work release, went to the work release program. That's about the only thing you can do.
Mike Brown, I've worked in the jail in Gary as a pretrial investigator with the correctional officers, as well as I've been in the county jail on several occasions to see how it operates. I have a great deal of respect for the correctional officers and the work that they do, and I talked to some of them, and they are not paid properly. I agree with the sheriff. As far as the overtime goes, as an administrator, because that's what I am, I would meet with my chief, and I would also meet with the warden and my financial people on a weekly basis to see how our budget's going. See, one of the reasons why there's waste is because you don't check it on a regular basis. Every office that I'm in, I check it on a regular basis because the budget should not be going up. It should either maintain or be reduced from, you know, people retiring and things like that. But we are wasting too much money, and there's no reason to waste the money. Even now, we're still wasting money. We have got to figure out a way to be smart. And me as an administrator, I'm going to check the bottom line. Thank you.
All right, Chris, please introduce yourself.
I'm Chris Nolte with Lakeshore Public Radio. Last week at an ethics breakfast, a case study was mentioned about a local police officer who was posting offensive material online. What would you consider to be a workable social media policy that would hold all employees, not just officers, accountable?
And I believe we're starting with Dan.
That's a tough area because of the fact that the Internet's not really regulated that way that much. If it's offensive, you would have to, you know, take it on an individual basis, depending on what actually transpired, what was said, how it was said. I would probably call that officer into the and find out what's, you know, what's going on, why, you know, this isn't appropriate. Because a police officer is a police officer 24/7. And it doesn't matter when, where, or how. If you're out in the public, you're still in the public eye. You're still representing the department. So it would be firmly suggested to them to knock it off.
Sheriff Martinez, one of the things that we're implementing is a social media policy for our police department. One of the things that we will not tolerate is officers being on social media while they're on duty. And it's unfortunate. You see that in every department when you're going through social media. You see police officers in uniforms and in their police car or responding while they're on duty, which they should not be doing. Another thing is that there has to be at first a complaint. Yes, you have free speech and you can say what you want, but at the same time, when you're a police officer, you're held to a higher standard. One of the things that you cannot do is bring a bad image that we have as part of our policy and procedures that will be bring a bad image or reputation to the police department. This is our rules and regulations. This is our policy. This is what you have to live by. So long as it's not bringing a bad image upon the police department, it will be investigated. It will be a fair and impartial, and a determination will be made if any disciplinary action be taken.
Hi, Betty Dominguez. I think it is shameful for a police officer to post nude or make rude remarks or sexual remarks on the Internet. That is only for a police officer. I understand their civil rights. The constitutional right for free speech. But you have to at least get the balance on that one. And to me, there is none. Either if you're a police officer, you cannot, at this point, use your office or your uniform to do anything that is rude to the public. I just don't agree with that personally.
Nate Hall, at the department that I worked at, we had rules, regulations, policies that were set in place that the officer was aware of and that he must adhere to. So if he violates those rules and regulations as far as social media is concerned, sending nude photos, et cetera, of himself, exposing himself, then he should be disciplined accordingly with the rules and regulations of the department that I worked at, and found also in violation of any laws that deal with the social media part of it as far as that officer is concerned, and he should be disciplined.
Richard. My name is Richard Ligon. First of all, we take things for granted. We take that officer should know. When I'm the sheriff, we're going to have ethics training once a year, and you're going to sign it. And things like this, it's going to be told. You're going to be told. There's going to be a standard operating procedure that's going to be in place. You're going to be told what you can and cannot do. It's going to be clear. If you sign this paperwork and then you violate it, then you're dealing with being disciplined, and I mean seriously disciplined. But in lieu of all this time you have on your hands using this, you need to be out doing programs like the Law in Your Community, working with the youth and the community, making sure they know the responsibility of police officers. So to me, that ethics training will be enforced. You will sign that saying that you clearly understand where when it's time to prosecute or deal with that as a discipline, you'll clearly understand.
I agree with Mr. Ligon. Actually, everybody on the panel today, I think we all are on the same page here with that. I don't think you should deface anybody. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's nice, and it shouldn't be done. And we have to also be reminded that people are constantly looking at us. I also believe that with Facebook and all the other social medias, there are some that do and some that don't. I see some now, officers, that have lewd remarks or profanity on Facebook and nothing's done. I think as closely as we're monitored for overtime or other things, we should be monitored for social media also. It's not right. Policy, the sheriff set a policy in place, and there probably is, which makes it contractual, not constitutional, where somebody can say you're violating their rights. No, you're violating the policy. And I totally agree with that, and I think that's something we need to have in place because we know, folks, we know what's wrong, what's right, what's bad, what's good, so we know better than that what to put and not put on social media.
Wally DeRose, right now there's a lot of litigation going on with this issue. Police officers are suing their respective agencies, saying they violated their free speech. And one of the way around this is what we did at the federal level. As soon as you're hired, you sign disagreement. Is your agreed to ethics? No ethic violation, no violation of policy per se. And you're reminded about this every 3 months when you take in-service training, whether it be in person or whether you take it over the Internet. You're reminded continuously. You're also reminded of this during your evaluation period. Bad evaluation equates to less of money. Loss of pay.
Mike Brown, I think all of us up here have either been sworn at one time to the Constitution of the United States or the Constitution of the state of Indiana. What I'm saying is the police have a tough job, and what we're not addressing is the issues that they have, and sometimes they're dealing with PTSD or alcoholism or depression. We're not dealing with that because they go from one call to another. We keep thinking that they're robots, and they're not. They're working two and three jobs. They're constantly on the defense. And I think sometimes these behaviors are based on the fact that there's some other things going on, and we haven't addressed it. And I think that's one of the reasons why I make a good administrator to be in the sheriff's office, because the sheriff's office needs a fresh set of eyes on it. It needs someone who understands both sides. If the sheriffs are properly trained, then the community is safe. Thank you.
All right. David.
David Dowling, excuse me, this cold here. you know, the social media aspect of things and ethics is very important. I'm proud that in my role and the town of Schererville, we've been involved with that ethics summit ever since its inception, and I'm very proud of that. The social media piece, you know, this has created lots of discussion at Chiefs conferences over the last several years of what is accepted, not accepted. One thing that is absolutely not accepted under my leadership would be the use of social media while they are on duty, obviously. But the key to all this is not only having people sign off on a policy, but it is training. So what we do in Schererville routinely, we do roll call training. So I would have ethics training once a year, and I'd also have regular roll call training to address the social media piece.
Okay. You're listening to the Lake County Forum on 89.1 WPR FM Lowell. We're streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Is that good for illegal, Bob? Getting the thumbs up from the engineer. We got our legal ID in. All right. Now let's go ahead. I've gotten several questions, and really quick, if anybody has questions, if you're joining us late, please raise your hand, and the League of Women Voters will walk over to you. They'll give you a note card, pen, pencil to go ahead and ask a question for the candidates. About five or six questions came through. We'll start off with Oscar Martinez on this one. There are overcrowding issues at the Lake County Jail. The Department of Justice is overseeing violations at the jail. What are your priorities for improving the jail as it is currently?
Well, one of the first things is dealing with mental health. What we have established and with the judges is going through an ankle monitor program. And one of the things is what we just started just a few weeks or a couple months ago is a mental health court, along with working with Judge Vasquez and also with Judge Cantrell with the Veterans Court. So dealing with now not just with veterans, dealing with veterans, but we're also dealing with individuals in mental health. One of the things that I took upon myself is to look through our qualified mental health professionals and see who were all certified. Now, we only had one mental health professional that was in there when I first took office. We're now at six where it should be certified according to the Department of Justice. But some of those were not fully certified. Only four were. So I did reduce their pay to make sure that they were fully certified, fully trained to deal with the issues of mental health, get them through the mental health court so we can find a placement for them in a psychiatric facility.
Betty?
Betty Dominguez. You know what? That was the one thing I did as a probation officer, dealing with the mental health issue of the inmates. We worked with them. As a probation officer, we have to find that location, whether they go to Logansport when they are incompetent or to deal with the community as far as mental health, where they really do need to be, not in jail. The overcrowding in the jail, it's not because of all the mental health. It's because of all the unnecessary people that are being arrested and taken to jail for driving while suspended. I don't think that's necessary. I think police officers should be trained that there's certain crimes that don't need to be in the jail system. And that is minor offenses as long as it is not a danger to society. We do reduce the population in the court system because we deal with it. I introduced the monitor. I introduced the SCRAM program.
What's
I work
time,
with
ma'am?
Community correction.
Nate
Hall, there needs to be a medical staff created, doctors, nurses, et cetera, that will deal with these individuals with the type of emotional problems, behaviors that they have. Some are going to be violent offenders, while others are not going to be violent offenders. But these people, while they are in jail, need to be treated so they can be released from jail if, in fact, they are not violent offenders and get the proper treatment that they need. Unfortunately, that's not happening right now, but hopefully in the future that can, and we can reduce the population that side as well.
Richard.
Thank you. Richard Ligon, like I stated earlier, there will be a walkthrough, if not one time, at least two or three times a week, minimum. But I would try to go through that jail every day to make sure that no one's rights are being violated. There are alternatives. I was a probation officer. I was a parole officer. And my job was to keep them from going back to jail. That's going to reduce that population. We also have different programs, and I mentioned one about the Memphis program. I don't think someone for driving under the influence, or especially a veteran doing that, should be a temporary housing. Let's not put them in jail. We got to protect the public, though. We don't want them going out getting drunk. But that Memphis program is so effective that the people from the VA actually come over and pick these veterans up and take them to sleep it off or something over in the jail. But we're not treating them like criminals, and I'm not saying that if they were not arrested that wouldn't be an issue. But my thing is to walk through that jail every day and make sure that people
Sir, are being. That's your time.
Maria Trajkovic, I believe also walking on a daily basis into the jail for daily operations is should be mandatory. We should do that as our responsibility. That is our number one priority, is the jail. I think overcrowding, absolutely right. These driving while suspended, why aren't we doing something about that? Most officers, what they'll do is they will have the vehicle removed if there's not a valid driver in the vehicle at that time when they stop that driver that is suspended prior, and then make sure that that person is either can take the vehicle, the valid driver can take the vehicle, and that person will see their day in court. They're not all arrested, and we can continue to do that. We can long form them. We don't have to take them and arrest them and house them in our Lake County Jail. Also, our mental health issues, absolutely. What happened to rehabilitation? What are we doing when we have these people that are coming into jail for possession and they have these addictions? When we are treating them and we're helping them, are we following up with these folks?
Ma'am. Wally?
Wally DeRose, time and time again, the sheriff throughout 30, 40 years has been tasked with the responsibility of having overflow of inmates into the facility. It's a never-ending question. The problem is that many of the sheriffs haven't stepped forward to the Board of Commissioners and said, look, this is a problem we got. Unless we solve it, there's going to be a danger to the community. You need diversion programs, and we need a separate mental health facility for processing. That's the spokesman that the Sheriff's Department is supposed to maintain. He's supposed to be the administrator. He's supposed to be the loudmouth for the safety of the community. He's supposed to be the advocate, and that's what I'll be, I assure you.
Mike Brown, Sheriff Tom Dart, who's the sheriff of Cook County Jail, which is the second largest county jail in the country, he has a mental health problem there, and he has a female psychiatrist to deal with the inmates. And the reason why that is because he's addressing the mental health issue. I don't think we're addressing the mental health issue like we need to in the jails. And I think we need to add, like they were saying earlier, because I have to agree with some of them on that, but I think we need to add a special area for the mental health, because when they do the evaluation, they know that these people have mental health issues. And another thing is we need to be more sensitive to people when they don't commit serious crimes and do like we did in the past, you know, give them an opportunity to get themselves together. You can't arrest your way out of it. That's what I'm trying to say. And part of the overcrowding is over-arresting.
David.
David Dowling, I know the question started out as a jail standard issue. So first of all, I wanted to kind of get back to that part of the question. You know, I've had the experience for the last 10 years to run a police department that is nationally accredited. And what that is all about is meeting standards. We've done that for the last 10 years. Last year at our national process that we went through, we had a perfect score. I'm very proud of that. It's about holding people accountable and sticking to your standards. As far as the jail goes, we're talking about a lot of things related to mental health. Mental health is directly tied to, I feel, the opiate problem. And while we have to have programs that we put people in so they don't reoffend, we should be looking at the piece that prevents them from offending to begin with, some of the programs we were talking about with our opiates. And the last thing I'd say is I would like to be talk about having a community advisory panel where we bring together faith-based community, business leaders, the youth, and the command staff at the Sheriff's Department to help develop these programs. Those are very critically important in
That's
community policing.
All right.
Dan Bursak. The problem starts on the streets. You have your officers when they pick up somebody. You can't, if by any chance you can, long form them. If it's just, you know, it's not a serious offense, or if it's just a suspended, driver's license, you long form them. You make sure that they get home, whatever you need to do. Inside our jail, we have a fully functioning courtroom that's not even being utilized. Why not get a judge or a magistrate that would be willing to work afternoons and stuff? Let's, you know, get these guys arraigned and get them out of there. That's what you end up needing to do. The faster you can do. If a person has been adjudicated, they've been sentenced any time over 180 days, process them and get them downstate. Don't keep them in our jail.
Okay. Just a quick note of the time. We've only got about 20 minutes left. We'll be wrapping up at 7:30 this evening. This question will begin with Betty Dominguez, and I'm going to go ahead and paraphrase a couple of audience questions. What specific additional training, if you are elected as Lake County Sheriff, would you propose to have the deputies go through, and why? With regards to, as we've discussed today, taking a look at the opioids and narcotic situations, letting some traffic instances, being an unlicensed driver, do you let that slip by? What are you looking at in terms of the best resources to go into training for Lake County deputies?
You know what? The sheriff's office is a chain of command. There's the sheriff, the chief, the deputy chief. All that are the people that runs the sheriff's department. The training is what the police officer should be getting to begin with. They are trained officers. I respect police officers. They work really hard. They go on their own and get the training that's necessary. I have not seen a police officer that has not gotten any type of training, whether it's in drugs, homicide, that they do every day, or traffic stop. Because when they go out there, their life could be in jeopardy when they put on that uniform and stop someone. So the training has to come within the command staff to make sure that they are doing that. All police officers should have training, as well as probation officer. We all have to train, because that is part of our job, is to understand the community and making sure that we are able to perform our job.
Nate
Hall. As far as training goes, I believe that there's probably two or maybe even three aspects of training that we should always try to improve on, especially in light of everything that's going on in the country today. One of the most important ones would be diversity training. The officer needs to be able to learn how to interact with all types of individuals, regardless to whatever neighborhood it is or setting or area. Diversity training is very important, and we must continue to build upon that. And the second part of that would be no shooting training as far as incidents are concerned or the officer is confronted with, so he will have some idea and training as to when to shoot and when not to.
Richard.
Yeah, Richard Ligon. Some of the training I've had, which I think was most important, was hostage crisis negotiation. That helps you to really be able to communicate with the community. That's a very important one. But the most important one that I think needs to be done is being able to recognize handicap. If someone cannot hear and they don't stop, are you sensitive to that? I talked with a group of people. We need signs that will let people know that person can't hear or that person can't speak. There's a program called the Law in Your Community that teaches police officers to go out and have these meetings with the community and really work close together. And most of the times, the police will probably learn more than the citizen. But it teaches them, how do you react if you approach by a police officer? And that's very important because of the crisis and the things that are happening nowadays. Those are things that I think even the police are concerned about. So those are three main things that I think needs to be emphasized in training.
Maria
Trajkovic. I believe that our training, we have extensive training in our department. We have the ethics training and diversity, and we have the shooting, and we have training. The thing is getting everybody on the same page with the training. Patrol has certain training. Criminal investigations has certain training. Transporting prisoners, certain training. SVU, dealing with juveniles. We're all police officers, whether we're delivering papers in a civil service, whether we're transporting prisoners, whether we're doing criminal investigations or patrol on the streets. We should all be on the same page with the same training. Now, granted, I understand that we're all doing different things, but it's all police work, folks. We all need to know what one the other is doing. So when we are transferred, which we are many times throughout our careers, we can easily move into that slot and perform that job just as any other officer. But that would mean putting everybody through the training equally as you would any other division. Also being able, being sure that the officers are able to do the training.
That's your time, ma'am. Wally?
Wally DeRose, how do you teach common sense? Common sense starts at the top with leadership, and then it goes into official training. My department, Sheriff's Department, will have a diverse officer. He or she's responsible to head off problems as they come. Also, graduates will go to the FBI Academy at the command level or the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. But once again, common sense has to be taught. We need use of force training every 3 months by the PC.
Mike Brown, one of the things that happens when you become a police officer, you go to the academy, you get yourself physically fit. I think the physical fitness is important as part of the training. I think that helps the mental part of an officer. I think the command staff would need to get together with the officers and make it clear that part of the problem with the training is, are they fit to go do all this training that she mentioned? I think that has to be an issue that we have to address, because at the end of the day, if they're physically fit, emotionally and mentally fit, they're better police officers. And it takes, because they're under a lot of stress, I keep stressing the matter, because they go from one call to another, they deal with all these things on the defense. So we need to figure out a way to be more supportive in the way that we train them, and I would be just the right person for that.
David.
David Dowling. You know, in law enforcement, we train on a variety of things. Traditionally, we've done the typical police stuff and shooting and defensive tactics and all those things. But in today's world, you know, under the Barack Obama administration, he had the Commission on 21st Century Policing. And I think it's critical in law enforcement that we adopt the principles of 21st century policing, and that is community policing, because it is so important that we get out in the community with faith-based groups, business groups, and develop those relationships, because when you build those relationships, it helps you get through the difficult times. The first time you meet a police officer should not be a moment of crisis in your life. You should have had a positive interaction with it, and that's my goal with the youth and with the adults of the community.
Dan.
We have a mandatory training that every police officer has to do every year just to keep his police powers. But the one that we really don't do is the Constitution. When's the last time? See, I'm a firm believer in the Constitution to the point where I actually carry always on myself a copy of the Constitution. I get elected sheriff, I will actually hand these out on my own dime to every officer and make sure that they know that what they can and cannot do according to the Constitution, to make sure that they don't violate anybody's civil rights, that anybody, you know, comes across a police officer's knows that they'll be treated fairly. And that would be the easiest way for a policeman to be able to address the public and stuff. What they don't teach anymore also is the levels of regression. When I went to the
academy. That's your time, sir. Oscar.
Thank you very much, Sheriff Oscar Martinez. One of the things that we've done is, in fact, we're doing it this week, that we implemented that every officer, every correction officer, every civilian, including the command staff, is going through diversity training. Now, the diversity training is not just based on the color of your skin, but your culture as well, because as we understand, in Lake County, we're a melting pot. We're a big, diverse county. So when we're hiring officers from down south, up north, central, I think it's important to have a diversity training, which we're doing as we speak. The next thing is de-escalation.
knowing to de-escalate a situation before it gets out of hand. And secondly, is case law. We have case law out there that protects victims against mental illness or imminent threat with somebody that has a handgun. And knowing the law, knowing when you can seize it without a warrant, hold it until a court order says that you can release it, is important, because that is what's killing people, the gun issues in this country.
All right, this is going to be the final question of the evening. And Michael Puente, it is for Nate Hall to lead us off.
All right, here we go. The term fake news is used a lot lately to describe news stories that elected officials don't agree with. How will you work with the local media to ensure transparency and accountability?
That's a good one. Well, let me say this here. That term has been used by one person in particular, more so than any other individual, first of all. Secondly, I believe that all journalists, newspaper reporters, writers, whatever your occupation may be as far as journalism is concerned, should have the right to voice your opinion regardless to what other individual, myself or anyone else, would like or dislike. Secondly, fake news to me is a made-up term, which means I don't like what you said. So with that, I'm going to leave it at that.
Richard. Richard Ligon, part of my training, too, I was a public information officer, so I had to, anything that came across, anything we did, the media was going to call. And to me, you have to be honest, you know, and I've learned never to say no comment. That's just something you don't do. Forget all the facts. You know, when you present something false or you make up stuff or you that somebody's going to find out. Somebody somewhere knows that they actually know what you did not do. So to have fake information is unacceptable. More people need to be trained in public information to make sure that they're transparent. The information that they're providing to anyone, even another public official or another office, you have to make sure that the information is accurate. So I strongly believe in that training in public information to make sure that fake news is not given to anyone. Thank you.
Maria Trajkovic, I think that's another building trust with the community and communicating with the community and letting them know you're a social influence, not a power-hungry authoritative figure, and to be able to talk to the community and meet with them and advise them, develop some type of meeting where you can meet with the folks once a month and let them know who you are, what your department's doing, and find out what they would like to see or how they would like to see us handle things and communicate. I think by not communicating and not informing the public, that's where the fake news develops, making sure that they get the facts and pulling back the curtain, folks, and being real and letting folks know honestly what's going on at the Sheriff's Department. We have to start being trustworthy with the community. We are part of the community. We're taxpayers also. Why can't we just be honest and let them know what's going on? So I believe that's a way to deter fake news between us and the community.
Wally.
Wally DeRose, the federal government, two agencies I was associated with were great, but not releasing information right away. And I couldn't figure out why until I became a public information officer myself. And then I learned you get the facts quick, and you've got to have a bridge to the news media with basic information before you release anything else. It has to be a foundation there for truthfulness and fact, and that's done through your public information officer, who's usually chosen from the ranks. We had agents. We didn't have none police officers, no law enforcement authority. They didn't do it. We had specific people responsible for that who were familiar with the cases and could accurate information to the media.
Mike Brown, in the last 20 years, I've been dealing with the media, whether it's the coroner's office, the recorder's office, and currently the clerk's office. I always have a point person to deal with the news media. We do not hold back the news. If it's something that you need, when it's available, we will get it to you. As sheriff, that will continue, because the bottom line is we're serving the public, and we have to be honest with what occurs. So therefore, we're not going to hide anything. We're not going to sugarcoat it. We're going to deal with it just like it needs to be dealt with. We're going to work with the other agencies if they're involved in the process of getting that information out. But it will be done in a timely manner, in a professional manner, and the public has a right to know the truth. Thank you.
David.
David Dowling. I think the piece that we refer to as, quote, fake news is always talking about news that someone doesn't like. That's been the environment that we've had. But I think when you're talking about the relationship with the media is no different than any other part of your community. You need to have build a relationship with those people, and you have to have trust between them. And so when you tell a reporter that I can't give you this right now, but I will as soon as I can, they will believe you. They'll understand that. And you do that by having them involved in what you're doing and all your community-based things. Like, for example, in Schererville, you know, we have community watch meetings. We invite the media all the time. Coffee with a cop, morning call, cop camp in the summer, women's self-defense, national night out, all those things that we include the media with. And that's part of the whole building the trust factor, whether we're talking about a community policing initiative or whether we're talking about a major crime or incident that happened in our town. So I think it's critical to just build those relationships with the media so you build trust.
Dan.
Dan Bursak. Have an open-door policy. Plain and simple. If I'm fortunate enough to be elected sheriff, I'll be the first Republican sheriff in over 70 years. So if you don't think I'd be under scrutiny, that you have another thing coming. I'll get it from the media. I'll get it from the public. But that's what I want. I want the people to look into my office and see that there are no skeletons, no corruption, no nothing. So I have an open door policy, not only to the media, but to the general public.
Since taking office, I believe I've done pretty good in with the media. I had an open line of communication with the media, easy access, especially when it deals with the Freedom of Information Act. We've been acting promptly on that because there's times that there are investigations that are going on, and there's only limited information that we can release. But I think I have a good working relationship with the media. It'll just get better. We didn't have much of a transition period. Been pretty busy getting things, a lot of things done. But another thing that I plan on doing is involving the media in a lot of our operations that we can involve them in. When we're doing sweeps, going after individuals that are wanted or deadbeat parents that haven't paid their child support, it's involving the media in what we're doing. It's fascinating what we do. We have a lot of passionate officers that love their job, and I'm willing to share that with the media.
And Betty.
Betty Dominguez. You know what? Communication with the media has always been there. The media has always been persistent in getting the news. The problem is candidates or politicians doesn't want to hear that. And they don't know what they're going to write. So they're scared. Sometimes they don't want to tell the truth. And that's what becomes fake news, because it travels a lot faster than you can see, especially working in the county. You hear it from one end, it's already at the other end. That's the way it works. And let's not be naive about it, okay? News travels fast. The media catch on pretty fast, because you read it all the time, okay? They're good at their job. But at the same time, I agree. There are privacy with the sheriff's department as far as doing investigation. Those are the things you can just tell the media. But maybe a community oversight committee and the chief of staff, which the sheriff's department has, can work together to have a better communication at this point to allow the community to know what is happening the sheriff's department.
And let's go ahead. We've got 30 seconds now for everybody to go ahead and give final thoughts, and we'll start down all the way to the left. Nate, go ahead and start.
Okay. I believe that in order to be a good sheriff, you're going to have a lot of experience, a lot of different areas. I believe that that person truly must care about the community, the people in the community. That individual must be able to lead and have the ability to lead, and if that individual has all of those characteristics and traits, then you should elect that person as your Lake County Sheriff.
Betty?
Betty Dominguez. I do understand the needs of this community. I have worked in this community for 33 years. The sheriff must have the administrative skills and the knowledge and maturity and the experience working with everyone in the criminal justice system to be effective. You can't just do one thing. The criminal justice is involved with the courts, the prosecutor, the prison system, and other police agency, from the FBI to the state. We all must work together. This is for the community.
That's
Thank
your
you.
Time. Oscar?
Sheriff Oscar Martinez, since I've taken office, we've done a lot of things. We've done a nationwide search for a professional warden, which we accomplished. We hired a psychiatric nurse practitioner, which we hired. That was one of the two top things in the Department of Justice. Since I've taken office, I've demonstrated to the people of Lake County that I have the administrative experience, the training, and most importantly, the passion that is needed to be your Lake County Sheriff. While moving forward together with your help, your trust, we will continue what we started to make Lake County a safe place to live in.
Dan. Please refrain from applause. Dan.
Dan Bursak. I've been on the department for 26 years. I've seen a lot of politics in this office, and that's the biggest problem in the Lake County Sheriff's Office. I've worked under three different sheriffs. They've all had said, I'm going to get politics out of the office. They didn't. It's the same now as it was when I first started. The problem in Lake County total political system is corruption. You're the ones that can break that corruption.
Time. All right, David.
David Dowling. My dad was the former police chief in Hammond. The day I graduated from the academy, I was there in my dress blue, surrounded by my family before graduation began. My dad pulled me aside to talk to me. My dad told me, son, there will be a lot of temptation in this job. There will be people that want you to do the wrong thing. He pointed at my nameplate on my chest and said, whatever you do, don't ever do anything to embarrass the name on your nameplate. For 34 years, I've kept that promise to my father. My promise to you is that I will never embarrass you and will do everything I can to restore the integrity and credibility of this position.
All right, that's your time. Mike?
Mike Brown, everything that I've said tonight is from the heart because it's a reflection of the 24-plus years I've had at the county. I believe that the problem with the police department is they're just too split, like was said earlier. When one side is in power, they punish the other side. When the other side is in power, they punish the other. They need someone like me, an arbitrator, someone that's going to come down the middle, is going to be fair with everyone. If you do your job, you're not going to have a problem out of me because that's what I do. I'm very fair with people, but you have to be able to do your job. We got to take the politics out of the sheriff's office. Every office that I've had, I've taken the politics out. Thank you. God bless you.
Wally.
Wally DeRose. I'm a veteran of urban law enforcement. I'm a veteran of federal law enforcement, and I'm a U.S. Army veteran. I started at the bottom, went to the top. There's not much I haven't seen in 45 years plus of law enforcement. The first thing I'm going to do is start an athletic program for the youth of our community. So there's a diversion from the gang into gang issues and with narcotics. Thank you.
Maria
Trajkovic. I'm a 20-year veteran. I raised four children on my own. I was a single mother for 20 years before I got on the sheriff's department. I got on the department by an opportunity, and that's why I'm here today. And that's what I want to go by our mission statement that states it's to enhance the quality of life and love for Lake County by serving and protecting our community, and that would be by excellent law enforcement services, and that's what I would provide. I would be a social influence to our community, and I would be a fair sheriff on our department. I am the least of the candidates here.
That's your time. Richard?
That's political.
Born and raised in Lake County. I served 36 years in the military, 23 years as a federal agent. And we must develop trust between our law enforcement community, and our community of Lake County. I have two top secret clearances, one from the military and one for federal law enforcement. And that's enduring financial. They put you through some changes to get that national top secret clearance. So
that's your time. Thank you to everybody who came out this evening. Thank you to all of the candidates who came out this evening for the forum. Just a reminder for anybody out there listening who may have missed it, anybody out there this evening who wants to go back and re-listen to it, it will be in a podcast version on lakeshorepublicradio.org tomorrow. You can also read about it in the Times from Bill Dolan, as well as hearing more about it on Regionally Speaking with Chris Nolte on 89.1 FM. Thank you very much.